This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll preview a panel that's bringing together local hospitals and nonprofits to try and combat gun violence by learning from Boston's example. But first, Governor Dan Malloy is heading to New Hampshire today. As the incoming chairman of the Democratic Governors Association, Malloy is expected to talk about Hillary Clinton's plan to combat gun violence. In October, a federal appellate court upheld Connecticut and New York's strict state gun laws passed after the 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook. Clinton has proposed comprehensive background checks. She'd like to roll back legal immunity protections for the gun industry. We'll be talking with the governor about that in just one moment, but we're going to tackle some other issues. So I want to welcome back State Governor Dan Malloy to the program for a little bit. And thank you so much for joining us before your trip up to New Hampshire, sir.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
We want to get to a lot in a very short amount of time. But first, let me just ask you some of your reactions to the municipal elections this week. We noticed some overall low turnout. We did see pockets of really, really high turnout in some tight races. Are you noticing any sort of a trend? Do you think voters are engaged or disengaged around municipal elections?
Well, let me say this. As a Democrat, it was a great night for us. Republicans had said this would be a referendum on the governor. That's me. And that they were going to pick up. And they actually named towns like Fairfield and Derby that they were absolutely going to win. But when all the dust settled, Democrats did exceedingly well, picking up a place like New Milford, which we haven't had in a long, long, long time, and reelecting somebody in Reading, which is a very Republican town. So I think it was a good election. There is a reality. I think the Secretary of State said this to you, that it appears that in many places turnout was down, and I think that's true. That makes it even more unusual how well Democrats did, because usually Democrat turnout falls in off-year elections even faster than Republican turnout does.
One place where there was a lot of turnout and Democrat won was in Bridgeport. Joe Ganim is returning to the mayor's office there. I know you've talked about this a little bit beforehand, and it caused a lot of, I'm sure, difficult conversations for a lot of Democrats in the state about this. What's your reaction to Joe Ganim being back in the mayor's office in Bridgeport?
Well, he's back. And whether people wanted that to happen or not, he's been elected by his constituents. And my job is to work with every mayor and first selectman in the state, whether I would have voted for him or would not have voted for him, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, whether we agree. They have an agenda that they want to move. It's my obligation to work with them, and I'm certainly going to treat Mayor Ganim the same way.
There's a bit of a redemption narrative around him, someone who served his time. Now he's back leading a city. Is there something to that? The fact is, you've served your time. You want to come back and now serve your city? You should be able to.
It's a little unusual.
Yeah. I want to turn to something that we've talked about a little bit, but I know I got a chance to visit with you. You had a big event over at Rentschler Field in which you were laying out some of your budget proposals. This is all in the middle of some negotiations over plugging a hole in the state budget right now. I'm wondering, first of all, if you can talk about the negotiations that you are having with state lawmakers, both on the Republican and the Democratic side. I know the first thing that you're kind of talking about is, what is the size of the problem we have right now? You've already made some budget rescissions. As we've talked about, they weren't necessarily overwhelmingly popular, but you said, well, come back to the table with other ideas. Now you're back at the table. How big is the hole right now? Have you agreed at least on that?
Well, I think we've agreed on a range of what the hole is, which is, remember, we've made $103 million in cuts already, not popular, but in place. People have complained, and I said, well, put your ideas on the table. To the point where I had called them into the room and continuing today, there aren't any ideas on the table, but I think next week people will put their cards on the table finally. With respect to that size hole, and I don't want to have this sound larger than it is, we've agreed that the range is $350 million to something a little bit higher, but included in that 350 would be the 103 that we've already made, and let me assure you, I stand by those. $85 million in what's are called unallocated lapses, which we've allocated. So you take those two numbers out of 350, and you get the number.
Okay, so we have a range now that we're dealing with. I've heard from some of your Democratic colleagues who are saying, look, we want to make sure we get back some of the hospital cuts that were made in the first round of rescissions. So obviously that's not going to go to plug the hole. We've heard from some other Democrats who are questioning one part of your plan that you laid out last week actually extending some tax relief to businesses. So I guess I'm wondering, before we even get into Republican plans and conversations about this, is what sort of conversations are you having with the Speaker of the House, with the Senate Majority Leader, about the things that they really, really want out of this budget plan that we're going to put together?
Again, and people really haven't put their cards on the table. I mean, I'm out there making cuts, telling you what I think we need to do next, including how do we make Connecticut a more business-friendly state in the region. I think we could be the most business-friendly state in the region if you compare ourselves, say, to New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and the rest of New England. I think there's no reason that we shouldn't be seen as the most business-friendly. On our corporate tax basis, we are probably the most friendly right now. So we need to address that issue. We started that effort with eliminating about 1,000 pages of regulations that we thought were just cumbersome, overly broad, or duplicative of federal. We should continue that process and do a whole bunch of other things. So I'm hoping in the next 7 to 8 days, Republican leaders, Democratic leaders will put their cards on the table. It's easy to be against things. It's when you have to try to put money or decide how you're going to spend the money that you have, which happens to be slightly less than you thought you had.
You're not against the idea of restoring some of the funding to hospitals that were cut if indeed other money is found in the budget to make up for that?
I'm not against it, but I will tell you I'm not for it either. The hospital industry made $1 billion in Connecticut last year. 2008, they lost money. In 2014, they made $1 billion. And giving them more money in when we're not funding group homes to the extent that we should. This is a group of people that haven't actually seen increases or commensurate with inflation even. Where are we going to take it from? But listen, if somebody comes with a great idea, we should take a look at it.
Given all of this, is now the time to be making any adjustments at all to some of the business taxes that were proposed and then passed during the last legislative session? If we are in a hole that's somewhere in the $300, $350 million range, is now the time to do this?
We're not really in a hole of $350 million. Again, I want to say we took $103 out and we allocated $85.
But if we're in a hole
A couple of hundred million. The tax changes that I would suggest for the current year have a cost of about $5.5 million.
Yeah. And what are those? Explain exactly what they are.
Context.
Yeah.
I've made some suggestions with respect, for instance, we have corporate headquarters in our state, corporate headquarters that we want to keep. It's not unusual that corporate headquarters have to bring employees from around the country to that headquarters. Historically, we have said you need to pay taxes and account for a salary on a single day. Doesn't make any sense. It's overly burdensome, not particularly well complied with, except by a few companies. What I've said is, hey, listen, you need to start paying those taxes or collecting those taxes at day 16, not day 15. The idea that travelers who brings people in to go to their traveler's university and has to track if the person's here a day or two doesn't make any sense. It's one of those very burdensome taxes that bothers the heck out of people. And quite frankly, in some cases, is even more expensive to process than we're actually raising in revenue. Now that we would exempt movie stars and concert folks and talent who, you know, come in and make $100,000 in a day, then they need to pay their taxes on that $100,000. But if we're talking about people who are coming to our state for training, and by the way, they're spending money for meals, they're spending money for hotels, we're getting our share. So that's one of the big changes that I have said we should do, and I think it makes a lot of sense. A couple of other things that I've said we should take a look at. I was not an advocate of the unitary tax. Everybody, I think, in the state knows I'm not an advocate of the unitary tax. It wasn't my proposal. But since the legislature included it in the package, we've studied it a lot. And what we've come away to the conclusion, and the reason we didn't study it a lot before is, quite frankly, I'm not the advocate. But what I've come to the conclusion is there is some good things in the unitary tax. For instance, retailers should be paying a tax on their profits for sales in our state. Right now, if we don't use that as the factor, that is the sales in the state, a company like Walgreens in Arkansas, Target can say, hey, we have so many more employees in Arkansas or in Minnesota, we shouldn't have to pay you taxes. Well, yeah, you do have those employees, but you're getting all the taxes that you collect because, you know, on income and property taxes and sales taxes by those folks who live in those jurisdictions. We want you to pay your taxes based on how much sales and profit you have in our state. By doing that, we clear up a lot of the unitary tax confusion that exists amongst companies. We make it much easier to collect, and I have suggested that.
The only thing I'd say is that with both of those tax proposals there, they're aimed at, you know, as you suggest, travelers earlier, and many people have said, GE, of course, which is talking about moving out of Connecticut, has complained about the unitary tax. Those are companies that make billions of dollars, too. You've talked about the hospital system making $1 billion, and we need to cut state funding to them. But there's a lot of corporations here that make $1 billion, too. Why should they be let off the hook during a time of fiscal crisis when we need to cut back state government?
They shouldn't. And I'm not proposing that we let them off the hook. In point of fact, if you want to continue to be a corporate headquarters state and benefit by being a corporate headquarters state, then you have to be realistic. So I'll put it this way. Why would travelers continue to bring their people to our state for training as opposed to one of the other states where they're training people if we're going to make them pay taxes every time they bring someone just for training purposes? And by the way, they're renting a hotel room. They're paying for meals. There's a limousine service probably picking somebody up. So we're collecting our piece. So I believe people should pay a fair portion of the taxes. And what we think on the unitary tax, that the number one factor should in fact be what your sales in the state. I think that's a fair way to do it. And by the way, it'll bring in a lot of revenue.
We're talking with Governor Daniel Malloy for a few minutes here on Where We Live. We're going to be talking about guns in just a moment. I just want to quickly ask you about the other thing that you rolled out. And this is a big proposal that I'd like to have you explain a little bit to us.
Let me just say one thing about the hospitals, because you've mentioned it twice. Sure. You know, hospitals in our state, all but one are not for profit. And as I pointed out to you, they made $1 billion last year in our state. And in many cases, they're paying their chief executives of a not-for-profit corporation substantially more than $1 million, including up to $3 million. And if you look at the top 10 people at hospitals, they're making a lot of money. In fact, the association pays its director. So the association, funded by hospitals, pays its director $800,000 a year. And they're arguing about this. I think healthcare has gotten too expensive. I think we're seeing that on a national basis. I think Republican candidates and Democratic candidates are talking about how healthcare has just gotten too darn expensive. And if you're going to not raise people's taxes, then you have to expect an industry that's making $1 billion a year in your community to trim its sales, or at least not increase what you're giving them, so that they can make more money.
And by the way, they're now spending quite a bit of money on some TV ads to ask you to actually put funding back in.
Let me go back to this. I think on the hospital side and the medical side, I think what we really need to be having is a conversation about how do you lower the cost. How do you make it more efficient? Not, hey, we want to spend more money and we want to give one of the hospitals, shortly before announcing a takeover, raised the salary of its chief executive 41%. Now, you and I have had a go-around about who raises
I don't think either one of us gave out raises of 41%.
Right. 41%.
Yes.
That's a lot of money. And I think in the future, the companies that are providing health care in our state, I think the state government, I think the private, the not-for-profit, everyone's going to have to look at this reimbursement issue and say, hey, can we really afford this any longer?
I'd like you to spend a couple minutes just before I let you go laying out something that you also talked about at this proposal, because you're talking about solving the short-term budget problems that we have, and those are the negotiations we were talking about earlier, but also about long-term debt obligations. And you're talking about revising our pension systems and the way we pay into this system in as clear a way as possible. Obviously, this is tough stuff, and I spent the better part of the day after that press conference trying to figure out how exactly it works. Explain what it is you're trying to do with the pension system and how it's actually going to work long-term for the state.
Long-term, it is working. Long-term, if you look at everything except Tier 1, Tier 1 is a group of employees, most of whom, the vast majority of whom, are already retired, who started their employment in Connecticut prior to 1984. There was no funding of a pension system at that time. Then what happened is people said, okay, we're going to start funding the pension. But quite frankly, the predecessors between then and my becoming governor didn't fund it, or they didn't fund it on an actuarial basis. And then they made matters worse. They started giving people incentives to retire early. What does that mean? It means you pay the person their pension, you pay them their medical benefits that they're not paying into, you hire somebody to replace them. In most cases, that's what happened.
Work's got to get done.
Work's got to get done. I'm governor with a smaller work staff than I started with, but I'm the only governor in recent times to end up that way. So you end up paying the pension, which is out of pocket, and then you pay the new employee, which is out of pocket, and then you start giving them raises. So what happened is we did change, and we went to tier two and other tiers. If you separate just on the dividing line of 1984, there's no real funding for any of that. And everything after that is well funded. In some cases, positive, more money in allocated for a particular group than they would currently draw down. On the other hand, if we are going to treat those pension obligations exactly the same, and we have to pay them, there's no doubt about that. But if we're going to build up a fund, we'd actually get to a cliff of paying about $6.6 billion in a couple of years, which is not going to happen. No one's going to do it. You know it. I know it. And the reason I know it is I can look at what every governor did before I became governor. I'm the only governor to 100% fund pensions. The only one in the state's history. We began a long-term look at the pension system about a year ago. I've seen the preliminary report. I think the final report comes out on Friday. And what's very clear is we're never going to pay – we're not going to go from $1.5 billion to $6.6 billion in a very short period of time to fund the pension obligations. Let's be honest. When we write a check to pay pensions right now, two-thirds of it goes right out the door to pay Tier 1. It doesn't get invested. It doesn't give us a return. It is pay as you go.
And this is for 2,000 employees who don't work for the state anymore, more or less.
No, this is for 29,000 employees.
29,000 employees.
Right.
Okay.
And 2,000 are active. Now, these are people who retired as late as the late 1970s and early 80s. If you do the math, none of us are going to live forever. So this is a quickly shrinking group. Mm-hmm. All right. So what I'm saying is let's be honest. That is a pay-as-you-go system. Let's treat it as a pay-as-you-go system. Let's calculate our obligations with respect to that group so that we meet those obligations on an ongoing basis in yearly budgets. And on the other hand, with respect to everybody who became employed after 1984, which is well-funded, let's keep well-funding that and make the appropriate adjustments, including increasing contributions as that group gets older. You do that on an actuarial basis. I'm 100% for it. I'm the guy who brought generally accepted accounting principles to the state government. That's how we should treat it. If we do that, we look at something along a flat system of payment at about $2 billion, maybe rising to about $2.2 billion before it starts to fall. That's an obligation we can pay. We're never going to pay $6.6 billion. You know it. I know it. Everybody listening here knows that we're not going to cut every other thing we do, nor are we going to raise taxes $4 or $5 billion in a year.
A last thing. We've run a couple minutes over time.
I'm having fun.
You're having fun. This is later on in the program, we're going to be talking to some folks who are coming to Connecticut to talk about some of the experience they've had in cutting gun violence rates in Boston. And I know that you're heading up to New Hampshire to be talking about this issue on behalf of presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. What are you going to be telling people in New Hampshire about gun violence specifically?
Well, I think, number one, the common sense beginning is a universal background check system, which we can't get through the Congress or the Senate at the moment, so we need to do it state by state. But we are going to get it through the Congress. If you look at the number of mass shootings that have occurred just this past summer in places like Oregon and many other places, there is a momentum building for background checks. If you can't drive a car without getting a license and you can't get on a plane without someone doing a background check, then why in God's good earth would you allow somebody to buy a gun over the internet and not do a background check? Why on earth earth would you allow somebody to walk into a gun show in Virginia and buy a gun and not have a background check done? So so I think that that's part of it. Senator Sanders voted against the Brady Bill. I think that was a mistake. I think we need to move in the direction of having common sense, state-by-state laws, and then build to a federal law, which will happen. It because there's going to be a mass casualty event in every single state. And in places like Colorado and Arizona, we're seeing multiple mass casualty events. So let's start with common sense. That's what I'm going to say.
Dan Malloy.
And by the way, that's what I said to the Brady annual meeting a week or two ago. And let me just share this. The Brennan Center came out with a report and said that Connecticut had decreased juvenile delinquency more than any other state in the nation, including juvenile incarceration, more than any other state in the nation. And we're doing that at a time and we've passed gun laws. And we're doing that in a situation where we are lowering crime, both violent and nonviolent, more rapidly than the national average. In fact, in 2014, it looks like we did that to the tune of about three times the national average decline. So we're making real progress on this. I know people in Connecticut get down on themselves. We're down on our state. We're down on our governments. The reality is Connecticut's a pretty safe place. We're building a Connecticut for the long run. That's why we talk about transportation. That's why I want to solve this pension issue and have everyone understand it, which is not easy. John, if you didn't get it,
I think I got it. Took some time, though. I got to tell you, man.
So, but you know what? But I was looking at it. I was looking at the report, and I'm saying, listen, let's have an honest conversation with the employee group, with the retirees, and with our citizens about what we need to do to get out of this problem.
Dan Malloy is the governor of the state of Connecticut. I'll let you head up to New Hampshire. Thank you very much for coming in, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to be talking about mass shootings and also violence in urban areas. We're going to be meeting with some people who are coming to Hartford to talk about Boston's experience. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. President Barack Obama spoke with frustration last month at a press conference after the mass shooting at Umpqua Community College in Oregon.
It cannot be this easy for somebody who wants to inflict harm on other people to get his or her hands on a gun. And what's become routine, of course, is the response of those who oppose any kind of common sense gun legislation. We need more guns, they'll argue. Fewer gun safety laws. Does anybody really believe that?
Of course, though, mass shootings are a big problem in America, as we just heard from Governor Dan Malloy and the president. But the majority of gun deaths are from individual homicides, from accidental shootings, and from suicides. The common denominator seems to be easy access to guns. The CDC itself says the best way to decrease gun violence is to decrease the risk factors that make gun violence more likely, conditions like poverty, lack of jobs, gang involvement, and easy accessibility to guns. Many communities around the country are trying to do this, including Boston and most recently Hartford, but it's not easy to change. Now, on Thursday, November 12th, a panel of experts on guns and violence will share their experiences in a forum sponsored by local hospitals and nonprofits. We brought a few of them in here today, as well as local experts. I want to welcome into our conversation first, Dr. David Hemenway. He's professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. He's the author of several books, including Private Guns, Public Health. Dr. Hemenway, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
You advocate taking a public health approach to guns. What exactly does this mean?
Briefly, if you wanted to have a one-sentence description, it's try to make society in a way, try to make things so it's easy for people to stay healthy and difficult to get in sick or injured. So if you want people not to be obese, make it so it's really easy to get good, healthy food as opposed to easy to get bad food for you, and make it easy for people to exercise rather than make it difficult and people be afraid to go outside even to exercise. If you want to be less gun violence, to make it hard for people who we don't want to have guns to get guns. One of the great success stories in public health, and there are so many, is in the motor vehicle area. We were used to be told, and it's true, that if no drivers ever made errors and that if no drivers ever behaved inappropriately, there'd virtually be no traffic fatalities. And so we used to focus solely on the driver. But then we quickly learned that it's really hard to change people that much. And what it's easy to change is the system. And so we ended up making a system where the cars are so much safer, the roads are so much safer and the emergency medical system is safer. And since I was a young adult, fatalities from motor vehicles have fallen over 85%. And nobody thinks drivers are really any better today than they used to be.
Of course, as mentioned by the CDC, gun violence in America is multifactorial, right? It's not just the number of guns. It's also poverty. It's a lot of social conditions. And might that make it harder to solve a problem like this that has so many things at the root cause?
I think that's true. But when we look at other countries, if we look at any other of the two dozen industrialized democracies, they have a lot of problems that we have. They have as much non-gun crime as we have. And yet their fatality rates are much lower. So we were just did a study of comparing the United States with the other 24 industrialized democracies, basically the free world countries, the first world countries. And just to give you one brief number, for children 5 to 14, this is K through 8. These are, you know, elementary and middle school students. In the United States, we have much higher rates of gun homicide, and not just a little higher than these other countries like Italy and France and Canada and Australia. They are not, you know, 50% higher or two times higher or four times higher. They're 18 times higher. A child in the United States is 18 times the likelihood of being murdered with a gun than children in these other countries. And our non-gun homicide rate is about average. The same way for these children about our gun suicide rate. It's 11 times higher. Our accidental gun fatality rate is 12 times higher. So, yes, we want to figure out ways to reduce violence like all these other countries do, but every one of these other countries have figured out a way to reduce the lethal violence because they figured out ways to have better reasonable laws about guns.
You've been conducting a series of surveys with various researchers to determine if there's a scientific consensus on some of these risk factors around guns. What have you learned?
So we've looked at just people who have been doing good research on this area. So they have to be first author of a peer-reviewed journal article in the last 4 years. And when we asked them, you know, questions about gun prevalence and problems with lethal violence, the overwhelming majority, typically it's 8-1 or 10-1, all say a gun in a house increases the risk of the family for a lethal death. And that where there are more reasonable gun laws, the chance of lethal death is falls dramatically.
I want to bring into our conversation Tiana Hercules, who's an attorney and a project coordinator for Project Longevity here in Hartford. And Tiana, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us by phone is Chris Biner, who's interim executive director of Boston Centers for Youth and Families. Chris, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
We're going to be hearing a little bit more about some of the experiences that Boston has had and try to learn some ways in which we can combat gun violence in our community. But first of all, Tiana, I want to ask you, listening to a little bit of what Dr. Hemingway has talked about already, maybe you can talk about how gun violence is a problem in some of the communities that you work with and maybe some specific things that might draw connections to the CDC statistics or some of what you've heard from the professor so far.
Sure. Well, I think it's no mystery or surprise that homicides by firearm is our most prevalent violent, you know, crime rate here in Hartford. We've experienced 28 homicides to date compared to 15 last year, and overwhelming majority of those homicides are as a result of firearms. The demographics and information on the victims, unfortunately, mostly Black and Hispanic men, young, about 24 to 35 age range, most living at or below poverty, with a criminal record, many of them. And so the dynamics in Hartford, unfortunately, is that, you know, there's a stressful environment, an environment that's been flooded with trauma, both victimizing and seeing violence, and then becoming a perpetrator of that violence. And so that is part of our dynamic here that plays into the gun violence that we see on the street in Hartford. But the readily accessibility to guns also plays into that. And listening to the governor's comments about, you know, making smarter gun laws, it makes a lot of sense, of course. But here in Hartford, people are usually obtaining those guns illegally anyway. And so will that really change the access to guns here in Hartford?
Well, and that's one of the big questions is when we have conversations about tightening gun controls in the country so that we close loopholes on gun show purchases or so that we make mandatory background checks available, a lot of people who support the gun industry will say, well, look, most of the murders are illegal guns and they're in urban areas and people are going to get them anyway. Could you just talk about how these conversations about gun policy, it's at a national level, actually play out in the communities that you serve? Because at the end of the day, those guns do come from somewhere. They're bought legally sometime, and then they end up in illegal hands.
Correct. And so, you know, the state-by-state approach may not help so much here in Hartford, but a federal gun law, for example, probably would, because a lot of those guns are purchased outside Vermont, for example, and then they find their way in our city. And so a federal approach would probably have a bigger impact on the accessibility to guns than some of our local gun laws. Not to say that the local gun laws are not a great measure and important in to prevent suicides and some of the mass shootings and things of that nature, but I don't think it will immediately impact the local violence that we see in Hartford because, you know, as many people know, the guns are obtained illegally anyway. And so that's usually how the conversations go, that they're not going to have an impact on the urban violence that we see in Hartford. They're great measures, and I think they're sensible. However, there needs to be, a top-down as well as a bottom-up approach when we're talking about gun violence in Hartford. And that not only requires legislation, but it also requires changing some of the systemic issues that we see that cause our communities to be impacted by gun violence, poverty, lack of employment, poor academic attainment, the trauma that the communities experience. All of those factors play into this very vulnerable and stressful environment that leads people to this sense of hopelessness and where they feel that they need a firearm to protect themselves and to carry out their business, which is usually something illegal.
And I want to ask Chris about that. I know, Chris, Boston has forged alliances with community members many years ago to address some of these risk factors we've been talking about that lead to violence in the city. How is all that playing out today in Boston?
Sure. So here in Boston, I mean, we're lucky, first of all, to have strong leadership in our Mayor Walsh and our Commissioner Evans. And, you know, I think that's been critical to some of the work that we've been doing here. I mean, it certainly requires a multidisciplinary approach, and you know, having your mayor and obviously your police involved in this is critical. But it's also the public health folks, the universities, and many of the service providers that we have here in Boston, whether it's the faith-based community or the community stakeholders, parents, but most importantly, requires us to have our young people at the table. And so for us, you know, we see all of this, coming together and melding. So Boston Centers Youth and Families is the largest youth and human service agency in the city of Boston. We've got a network of 35 community centers spread out throughout the city. And, you know, we see over 60,000 individuals annually who walk through our doors. And I think one of the great things about the work that's happening here in Boston is we use those spaces to really convene people, convene families, and provide quality outcome-driven programs and opportunities for families. It's important that we work closely together, but there's got to be this balance, around prevention and intervention, enforcement, and reentry strategies. And here in Boston, you know, we're working really hard to coordinate that balance. In fact, our mayor hired a public safety director to really coordinate those efforts here in the city of Boston. He's been in the office for 2 years now, and it's safe to say that we're seeing some really good success.
We're going to be talking a bit more about this panel that's coming up on November 12th. Hartford Together, joining hands for a safer city. It's happening at St. Francis Innovation and Learning Center. Put more information on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. We're talking today with three guests trying to tackle the gun violence issue in America. It's Chris Beiner. Tiana Hercules is with us. Dr. David Hemenway joins us from Harvard today. Before we head to a break, Dr. Hemenway, I'd just like you to weigh in on this. And I sort of talked about this with the governor, and this has been a theme on many of our programs about gun violence. I almost hear two distinct conversations in America developing. One has to do with addressing mass shootings, which tend to have certain patterns and have to do a lot with easy accessibility to guns legally. And then a separate issue, a separate conversation that's happening in America's urban areas where a lot of the guns are obtained illegally, but there are all these other factors that we're dealing with that make the violence maybe somewhat slightly different. I'm wondering if you feel the same way or you reject that notion that we're really having two different conversations about guns in America today.
Well, I would just argue that we should have one conversation about guns in America because guns can have some benefit, but they can cause lots and lots of problems and all very different types of problems. But there are the same way we have cars. Cars cause lots of different problems. We have problems with cars running over pedestrians. We have problems with cars rolling over. We have problems with cars catching on fires. So, but we can have a conversation about cars. One of the things I would emphasize is that, yes, guns cause lots of problems, and so we need lots of policies that make good sense about guns, because clearly we're going to have a lot of guns. One of the things, a big thing to emphasize is that there are lots of problems in the inner cities and lots of risk factors, and we should attack all those things. But still, in the Boston Miracle, you know, it's not like we solved all the inner city problems, but we were able in a very short time period to reduce the gun violence dramatically.
Yeah, there's still violence in the city, which we'll talk about, but not as many homicides. And Tian, I think that this is something that we've heard recently in this uptick in violence in Hartford. It's the easy accessibility to guns and then something that is just literally a beef between two people will escalate into a homicide very, very quickly because one of the individuals or both of the individuals have guns. And this is, frankly, something that we heard 10 years ago when a lot of the shootings were happening amongst 13 and 14-year-olds on the streets of Hartford. And we're hearing today when it's 28 and 40-year-olds on the streets of Hartford. And that seems to have not changed.
Right. It hasn't. It's just an all too easy means to carry out a grievance and to seek revenge or end a beef. And so the underlying reasons for that altercation and how to really deal with that is what needs to be addressed. I see the gun, unfortunately, it's just as a means to an end, all too easy, accessible means to an end. And there's all these underlying things that the individual is dealing with that they need to seek alternative means. But obviously, you take the gun out of the picture, they can't commit the homicide by the gun, but maybe they would carry it out in a different way,
but this is something, Chris, too, I talked about. And later on in the program, we're going to hear a clip from Hank Schwartz, who has been talking with us about gun violence in America for quite some time. He's at the Institute of Living. We talked about violence as contagion. We're going to hear from him in just a moment. But, Chris, one of the things I also talked to him about is that the gun isn't necessarily just a means to an end. It puts a certain power in someone's hands, right? It can alter behavior because you have the ability to act in a way that you wouldn't have if you didn't have the gun. I don't know how you see that playing out in your communities or the folks that you deal with, but that seems to be at the root of an awful lot of the issues that have to do with mass shootings, which tend to almost entirely be white males, often in the suburbs. But it probably plays some role in a lot of the shootings between African-Americans in Boston and Hartford.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we try to do here in Boston is really give real information. And I think, you know, oftentimes as we have our street workers who are out on the ground engaging youth and young adults around these issues, you know, one, it's having that positive, healthy adult who's connected to some young people who, you know, for all intents and purposes are not bad people. And so, you know, as we walk them along the continuum and try to create some positive alternatives and change their behaviors from, you know, some of the negative behaviors to positive behaviors. Yeah, guns have this sense of power, but we also have to remind them that the likelihood of you becoming a victim of violence increases exponentially when you carry a gun. And so, one, it's the behavioral change that we're really working on. And ultimately, when we get young people and when we meet them, they're carrying a gun, our goal is to get them to put the gun down and start to think about ways in which, you know, they can take the natural progression of anger and deal with it in a better way.
We're talking with Chris Beiner, who's interim executive director of Boston Centers for Youth and Families. He'll be joining David Hemingway, our guest from Harvard, on a panel discussion in Hartford called Hartford Together, Joining Hands for a Safer City. It's happening on November 12th. More information about that. We're also visiting with Tatiana Hercules from Project Longevity in Hartford. We'll be talking more about that program, and we'll be taking some of your calls at 860-275-7266 as we talk about gun violence in America here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we love to highlight some of the best local musicians around. And one of our favorite bands is coming back by tomorrow. West End Blend is live in our studio. They'll talk about their brand new record called Rewind, and we'll hear some of their music. We'll also mark the start of the Latino and Iberian Film Festival at Yale University. So some music and some movies tomorrow on Where We Live. Today on the program, we're talking about gun violence in America. We recently did a program about the contagion of gun violence. And here's a clip from Dr. Hank Schwartz. He's psychiatrist in chief at Hartford Hospital's Institute of Living. Here's what he had to say.
I do think we have entered a new phase, and I think that contagion is a good model for talking about it. In this instance, the contagion, I think, is fueled by disinhibition. The more an individual sees these kinds of incidents, and we're seeing them, you know, all the time, the more the incident becomes acceptable.
So that's Hank Schwartz talking recently in our program. And Dr. David Hemingway from Harvard University, I'd like you to respond to that. This notion that many public health professionals are really seeing violence, whether it's mass shootings that you see on television or urban violence that you see in your neighborhood, that there is a sense that you could treat it much like a contagion, something that spreads like the Ebola virus, for instance. Can you talk about that?
I believe there's no question that certain types of violence are contagious. That doesn't mean that it's a disease, but it really means that there's positive reinforcement mechanisms so that if you see violence, you're more likely to be violent. And there's a lot of mechanisms that explain that. One is what the academic talked about, but there's also exposure to violence. People who are exposed to violence tend to be much more likely to be traumatized, and people who are traumatized are much more likely to be aggressive. And this isn't in all types of violence. For example, in suicide, there are suicide pockets of contagion, but most suicide is not contagious. And one thing I would want to emphasize for the previous question you asked about, you know, our issue about gun violence is people should realize is that gun death rates are equally as high in rural and even in suburban areas almost as they are in urban areas. It's just that the violence is different. In the rural areas, it's suicide, and in the urban areas, it's homicide. And going back to the contagion, understanding that certain violence is contagious really helps, I think, in understanding that if you start on a good path, it becomes self-reinforcing, and instead of you can have a virtuous cycle. And indeed, I think in the United States for 20 years, in the beginning in the early 90s, we saw crime going down because a lot of it was contagious.
Well, one of the things that the doctor just mentioned, Tiana, in his answer there was about trauma, and we've mentioned this briefly, but the trauma that happens in areas where you just see violence over and over again, that can lead to more violence. How are you in Project Longevity, how are you dealing with some of the families who've suffered at the hands of guns?
Yeah, so one of the things that we started doing more recently, in addition to the call-ins, which I'll describe what that is, and I know Project Longevity is, you know, birthed out of, you know, Operation Ceasefire, the Boston Miracle. So very similar strategy that is used here in Hartford, where we call in individuals who are identified as those 900 times more likely to be a victim and or perpetrator of gun violence, and have a very frank and candid conversation with them about the consequences of gun violence, and also offer services and help in a way to kind of desist and get away from, remove them from violence, and those who carry guns, and that whole nexus and dynamic of gangs and violent groups. We started doing something more recently this past summer where individuals who are recently a victim of a shooting, where we go and do a custom notification with the victim. We go to the hospital or their home if they are out of the hospital, and we have this very similar conversation, but it's obviously more personal, and we offer services to them as well as their families, recognizing that because because their loved one has been victimized by gun violence, that increases the risk not only for them again, but also those who they're associated with in their family, younger siblings and cousins, and those who are looking up to these individuals who are trying to also remove from that lifestyle and try to put as many positive factors in their life as possible. So we partner with some of our great agencies in the community, Hartford Communities That Cares, Compass Peace Builders, who've been doing this work for a long time around intervention and trying to help families cope with trauma, because recognizing that there's studies that show that children's brain chemistry changes at the more they are exposed to violence. And so we cannot underestimate the power of that exposure and how that can really change the trajectory for a child and a young person. So trying to remove them from that and get treatment is really, really important.
Chris Biner, before we run low on time, I'm wondering if you can tell us one thing that you hope to tell the audience here in Hartford, one thing that Hartford or New Haven or Bridgeport can learn from what you've done in Boston that can help to solve some of these problems, or at least hopefully help to make things better.
Sure. I think one of the things that I would certainly tell people is that, one, you know, this can't be relationship driven. I mean, think one of the mistakes that we made here in Boston during the so-called Boston Miracle was that we relied on people and their relationships with, you know, from people, agency to agency. There really needs to be a blueprint in place. And the blueprint will enable us to really sustain the work as we move forward. And, you know, I think the other thing is it's really going to be important that people leave their egos at the door. You know, if you don't leave your egos at the door, you're going to run into all kinds of challenges. You know, I know that this issue, although it remains, that it's something that we certainly can have a huge impact on. And in fact, I you know, as we go into the schools daily and talk to young people around them, you know, the issue of violence, you know, one of the things that I always remind them is it's a learned behavior and we can do away with it.
Dr. Hemingway, how about you? Maybe in the last couple of minutes we have, give us one thing that you think you've learned from what Boston has done to help combat gun violence that you might be bringing to an audience in Hartford that we can learn from.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that for a while Boston was so successful is that it really did bring large numbers of different institutions together, all of them who really wanted to do something. And so everybody was willing to step up. And this is not only the faith community, but academia, law enforcement got together, probation got together with police. Hospitals really stepped up, schools stepped up, and it was a really shared vision that we as a community, if we all work together, could do something. And I think it was really important that it was data-driven, and I think it was really important that we had law enforcement that was willing to innovate.
Tiana, before we go, you and I looked at each other when he was talking about checking egos at the door. I've had conversations with people about Project Longevity in New Haven and across the state, and there's a lot of people who are trying to solve these problems. I've talked a number of times with Iron Nazario from Peace Builders. So much of this is about individuals and individual work, and people think, I've been doing this for 20 years, you know, but there really is something to this notion that both of the gentlemen had just said, that we really need to put things aside and say hospitals, government agencies, individuals, communities all have to come together and really try to find some common ground here, make a blueprint for how we're going to do this, right? It can't just be you, Tiana, working really hard with somebody else, because you're not going to be here at some point and the violence will probably continue.
Correct. I couldn't agree more. Collaboration and really being mission-driven and mission-focused on what is this about at the end of the day. It's saving lives and making our community safer. And every entity, organization, stakeholder, clergy person has to come with their best ideas and their best commitment in being steadfast to that and leaving some type of paper trail behind. So when they're gone, a framework can be followed and adhered to that everybody can coalesce around. It's not about territory or fighting for funding. We're talking about lives, and our most precious lives are those of the men in our community who are very much needed in their families and homes. And they're the ones that we're losing all too frequently here in Hartford. And so, we don't have time to battle about, you know, infighting and who has the best idea and whose idea it was or anything like that. It's really about coming together, collaborating, and really moving forward as a city. And so I'm excited. You know, I think we're in a time of change here in Hartford, and I think people are, you know, are really ready to continue to fight the good fight and really put those egos aside. And so this event coming up on the 12th allows us an opportunity to learn some of the best practices and really take an introspective look at what we're doing here in Hartford and what we can further do to keep moving forward.
This event is called Hartford Together, Joining Hands for a Safer City. It's happening Thursday, November 12th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. at St. Francis Innovation and Learning Center. More information on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. Tiana Hercules is from Project Longevity in Hartford. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Chris Biner from Boston Centers for Youth and Families, and also to Dr. David Hemenway, Professor of Health Policy at the Harvard School of Public Health. Continue this conversation online. Go to wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.